Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about the history of food production and consumption on The Larry Mueller Show today. We'll focus on the role of gender in driving food media and culture in the U.S. Emily Cantois is our guest. She's an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. Her new book is called Diners, Dudes, and Diets: How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. How do you think societal norms and pop culture shape what we eat? What questions do you have about the history of food and media? How do you think gender drives food consumption and production? Join in the conversation. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, hi, Emily. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jill. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. So how did you get interested in food studies?
So I was really interested when I was in undergrad. I was learning all about sort of ideas about health, ideas about nutrition, not just from a scientific perspective, but a cultural one. And so it was my honors thesis when I was 20, 21 years old, where I was interested in the diet culture all around me. I was a young woman trying to figure out, you know, how to move through this world and the body that I had. And so it was a way to sort of intellectualize, right, the world all around me, everything from, you know, the diet part of the menu at all Olive Garden to women's magazines, to Oprah's, sort of experience with her body.
Right.
So that was where it all started so many years ago.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, it's a great viewpoint because I don't think we think about that very much. You know, we now that you've brought it to my attention, I'm like, oh, yeah. But I really hadn't thought about it before. So excellent observation.
That's so much of my research, right?
Yeah.
These things that we think are trivial or, you know, sort of superfluous, just these silly everyday things or particularly things about pop culture, that they're actually really meaningful. They can tell us such powerful stories.
And they really do tell us a lot about our history when we look back on them, too, don't they?
No, absolutely.
Yeah. So what was the catalyst then behind your book, Diners, Dudes, and Diets? Was there a specific thing?
Yes. So going back to that honors thesis, I was writing it in the early 2000s. And so the two most popular diet books at that time were Atkins and South Beach.
Yeah.
And so because they were low carb instead of, just low fat, a lot more men did them. Men and women did Atkins in almost equal numbers. So it gave a different way to think about dieting. It had been so long considered for women and a quite feminine thing to do, to watch what you eat, to try and lose weight. And so those were diets that were kind of changing that. And so that got me really interested, not only in how men sort of thought about food and their bodies, but how things like food media, the marketing for weight loss programs, cookbooks that were imagined just for men, how did they talk about gender when trying to encourage men, to partake in these food activities that our culture considers kind of feminine or womanly. So it's really interested in how they negotiated that tension.
Because if you look at marketing for just about anything, it's been divided by gender since, day one, pretty much?
So I think target marketing, has been successful, for the advertising and marketing industry, for well over 100 years.
Sure.
But we're starting to see it break down. But you're right. For most of the 20th century, when we look at food advertising in particular, it's aimed at women. It's aimed at, Mrs. Middle Majority, this average consumer in the suburbs. And she was conceived of, right, as a nurturer, right? Food as love is this message that, was given to women through food advertising over and over again. So I was really interested in what happens, right, when that gets flipped and men are a little bit more a part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1950s, we definitely have, men grilling, right? Men sort of, contributing, right? The patio daddy-o, that they're contributing to sort of the domesticity of the home and to food, but in this way that's constructed, right, is sort of safely masculine, that this is how a dad or a man contributes to the family. And so definitely, we have a long history of these gendered ideas and very often gender stereotypes being attached to food through media and marketing.
And explain how the gender and power thing has driven food production and in turn consumption in the United States. Give us some examples of that.
Yeah, so I love you asking not just about gender, but power, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm really interested in. This is about access. This is about justice. This is about opportunities. And so in our culture and many others like ours, you know, the home came to be considered, you know, this feminine domain. It's really with the rise of industrial capitalism that all of a sudden work and leisure become separated in their spaces. And so women's work, right, this sort of, you know, phrase, it categorizes a lot of things that happen in the home, comes to be devalued because it doesn't earn a wage like the work that you go do in a factory, for example, at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. And so that idea, right, of cooking, cleaning, looking after children, being considered sort of feminine duties, is still with us in a lot of ways. And so we have good sociological data seeing, you know, even in, you know, really progressive families who might identify as feminist and, you know, really care about that equitable distribution of labor, sometimes it's still pretty inequitable in the kind of work that women are doing, because this isn't just about cooking and cleaning, but it's about finding the recipe that everyone will eat, including the picky eaters. It's managing in your mind everything that's already in the pantry. It's knowing the recipes. It's doing the shopping. It's managing the budget. It's clipping coupons. Then it's doing the cooking, the cleaning up, the serving. So it is a huge, you know, a huge labor to feed others. And then to go back to that message, right, of food as love, that as a woman, all of that food labor comes with a lot of social expectations for how you perform what we would quote unquote, right, good motherhood or good womanhood. So it's a weighty, you know, complicated set of labors that are considered sort of feminine. And so with food, if the work of the food, work of the home comes to be understood as feminine, that professional world of food comes to be understood as masculine. Professional chefs, restaurants, right? What restaurants get reviewed, what chefs get called geniuses or empire builders, right? That we still have big inequity in how that tends to be understood as masculine. And while we have more head women chefs than ever, it's still, you know, completely inequitable when we think about men and women coming out of culinary school at exactly the same rates. It's pretty close to 50-50. And then we still have 80% of those head chefs being men. So those are some examples as we think about the home versus the professional world, and that really, you know, entrenched sort of binary understanding of masculine, feminine, private and public.
Yeah, those are excellent examples of that. We see that so often. Do you think that comes from the fact that men were being paid, actually given money for what they were doing, whereas women, it was just expected, oh, you're doing that at home, so it's not as good as what people are getting paid for? Does money come into it?
Yes, that's definitely what feminist economists, right, or sort of historians of that transition say, that when the work of the home is without a wage, it comes to be sort of devalued in that big transition to, you know, working, you know, by the time clock, working for an hourly wage. That was a gigantic transition in American life. And so it was very gendered in how that was understood. And also this idea of, you know, the man working outside of the home, being the wage earner, the breadwinner, that this idea of the social roles attached to masculinity and femininity with ideas about wages, about money, about what your contribution is. That in my book, I also think about those pressures on men. So I think these ideas about gender, right, can produce inequity for both men and women when we think about how they cut.
Right. Let's go get a little bit more into the weeds here with your book. Okay, so buzzwords.
Sure.
Dude food and dad bod. We hear these things. What's the actual, the kind of deeper meaning of these terms, you know, in the context of your book?
So in my book, I'm really interested in a particular kind of masculinity that I call the dude. So unlike your sort of idealized form of manhood, right, who's competitive and he is that high earning breadwinner, right, and in his body, he'd be achieving, you know, we're striving to achieve like six pack abs and big biceps, right, this really fit body. The dude is instead our slacker hero, right? He resists some of those quite unreasonable demands, right? When we think about ideal masculine body types, the same way we think about the thin ideal for women. And so the dude, right, resists some of those energy expectations, and he's just going to slack off instead. So the dad bod is kind of this embodiment of that privileged way of being that's about just dropping out and saying, no, thank you, right? Like, I'm not going to work that hard. I'm just going to be happy with where I am. And so historically, I'm so interested in how the dude has a much longer history, but he pops up in a really big way in the 21st century, particularly with the Great Recession. This moment when it really and truly was harder, right, to get a good earning job, to buy a house. You know, many millennial men, right, graduate from college and have to go and live back at home. That there's this, you know, sort of delayed maturity that came with that economic moment that had social consequences, in part for how we define masculinity. At that time, you know, they referred to the Great Recession as a man session or a he session for the way it had these gendered effects on particular kinds of jobs and how it affected men. So in thinking about dad bod, right, as this body that resists all those expectations, you know, for muscularity, for achievement, for competitiveness, that was a media phenomenon that came out of, you know, a college newspaper in 2015, that this was a body that, you know, still works out, still goes to the gym, but it also, right, is one that drinks a six-pack of beer and eats a whole pizza by itself, right? That it has this, you know, ability to sort of, you know, it's the slacker hero again, right? That it's still fulfilling these demands, but gets to sort of slack off a bit. And then dude food, right, like pizza, you know, would certainly be an example. It's this sort of culinary genre that, as I researched it, I came to define as comfort food, but with an edge of competitive destruction. So it's definitely yummy, right? Uh-huh. We've all eaten dude food at some point, but that destructive element sometimes comes from, you know, the serving size being so gigantic.
Huge, yes.
Or the flavor profile, right? Might be really exaggerated, so salty or so sweet or
flaming
so spicy.
Flaming hot Cheetos, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So it has a little bit of a masculine element to it, right? That it's pushing the boundaries of, you know, are you man enough to eat this much, right? Or to eat, you know, this flavor that kind of hurts. So there's this nutritional element to it. There's a cultural element to it. And then, as we think about power, as we think about access and equity, you know, if we all ate like a dude all the time, that would certainly have negative consequences as we think about the food system and as we think about health, whether individually or on that population level. So dude food is certainly delicious. I would love to hear from local folks, right? What's the best dude food in your area? I know I gave a talk for some colleagues in Canada, in the Toronto area, and one of their restaurant sort of chains, local, has a couple. It's called the Burgers Priest, and it has a burger that's called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse Burger. And so it's a perfect example, right, from the naming convention to what it is, that, you know, it has multiple, you know, burger patties, it has fried onion rings inside, you know, tons of toppings, and then instead of buns, it has grilled cheese sandwiches on the top and bottom. So that's this perfect example, right, of the exaggeration, the excess, the playfulness, and then also the potential consequences of what
yes
means and how it embodies this way of being a man.
For sure, for sure. Well, we're talking with Emily Cantois about her book, Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. What questions do you have about the effect of gender on what we eat? What's your favorite dude food? We want to hear from you. Join in by calling 800-642-1234. Jane Rotunda and Natalie Guyette are our producers today, and Christina Maisha is our technical director. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. After 11:45 today, we're going to talk with the author of the new book, The Secret History of Home Economics. We'll find out about its origins and where the field is today, and it has a lot to do with what we're talking about right now with Emily Cantois. So, Emily, we were talking before the break about dude food and the dad bod, and I was thinking, you know, this is now acceptable. Dude food is fine with society. Dad bod is great. But do we have the equivalent? Do we have mom bod? Do we have lady food? I mean, that's not as acceptable, is it?
Exactly. So this is where the dude, right, only goes so far, right? He certainly made it a more flexible way to be a man, right? An easier way for some men, usually those who already had, you know, a fair amount of privilege in society, to be able to move through it. But it doesn't, you know, dismantle these broader systems of inequity. And so the dad bod's a perfect example, right? It doesn't dismantle diet culture, and it doesn't create space for mom bods, right? These actual bodies that gain weight when they make babies, right, and have a right to gain that weight. And so in that way, right, he still sustains sort of the existing status quo when it comes to gender and power. And while we've seen some movement, right, as we think about body positivity, as we think about different kinds of representations of men, women, and non-binary folks' bodies in culture, in advertising, in media, that we've still got a ways to go. And the dude certainly didn't help us get very far.
Not at all. Let's talk about gender contamination a little bit. You use that in your book. What's the role of it in the food marketing and branding?
So gender contamination is a concept that comes to us from marketers. The idea that consumers resist brand gender bending. So if a brand is perceived as feminine, men are probably going to resist adopting it. And so it doesn't work as strongly for women, though, right? Like,
no.
For, as a woman, to adopt a masculine brand, like, that can be kind of empowering or a way to sort of push back against the power status quo. While for men in a patriarchal society, right, there's a risk involved, right, to be perceived as feminine in a culture where men and masculinity, right, are still upheld as having the most power, the most access. And so gender contamination is this aspect that I was interested in my book, right? So if cookbooks, food television, diet sodas, yogurts of all things, and things like commercial weight loss programs are all perceived as feminine, right? If they're all perceived as this gender contaminated product, how did each of these brands go about trying to convince men that it was indeed manly or safe or okay to consume them? So I was interested in how they navigated gender contamination. And interestingly, in some cases, I'm not sure everyday men even are on board, right, with this idea of gender contamination. As I gave talks, you know, about the work I was doing on, you know, Coke Zero and Dr. Pepper 10, these diet sodas that specifically been made for men, you know, putting black and gunmetal gray cans, you know, so that they wouldn't be confused with Diet Coke. I definitely had people come up to me like, my dad drinks Diet Coke. My husband drinks Diet Coke, right? Like, I'm not sure there's really there. So sometimes I'm very interested in the disconnect between the stories that advertising VPs will tell us, right, about why they developed products, how they're thinking about gender in this marketing world, and then what actual people, right, actual men, women, and non-binary folks think as they choose these products. So it's a slippery concept. I'm fascinated by it, but I'm also not completely convinced that it's really at play in how we make all of our consumer decisions.
So basically, it's the marketing advertising folks that are telling people, their customers, the companies, that you need to do this in order to attract men, but that's not necessarily the case. Is that's what you're saying?
That's where it came out, you know, as I looked through, you know, message boards, comment boards, right, of how, you know, that there were plenty of men saying, well, I eat yogurt. I don't think it's girly. I eat, like, what's wrong with eating yogurt, right?
I know. I never thought that would be the case. Yeah, yogurt.
So exactly. Actual consumers didn't necessarily sort of embody or worry about that message the way some of these brands thought they did when they all of a sudden packaged yogurt, right, in black containers with the NFL logo and had, you know, nothing but football players promoting it. So I think that difference there is an interesting one and points to the power of food marketing, media, advertising, in playing a role in constructing what we think gender is, right? That there's great power there to either reproduce these ideas that could be regressive, conventional, or even straight up stereotypical and harmful, or to push the conversation forward and to really represent, you know, gender as far more flexible and inclusive. So that's, you know, one of the points, right? That there's great power in what advertising and media can do.
Absolutely. Because even though it's not some plot to do this, it does have after effects. I mean, even though if we don't, you know, we don't see that yogurt as being for men, it kind of gets into our subconscious, doesn't it? It affects how the social norms react. Is that right?
Yeah, so I teach courses on advertising with my students, and so there is always this tension between shape and reflect, right? That advertising and the media around us, they shape us, they affect us, but they also reflect, right, the culture at a particular moment, at a particular time. Mm-hmm. So it is this complicated feedback loop. And so that's why it can be really important, right, that when we change the representation, when we change the ad, or we change the way someone's represented in a TV show, that does, right, enter this cycle of how consumers make sense of that. Does it resonate with them? What do they say about it on Twitter, right? How do they think about it within their own, you know, fandoms, right, of the right. media they love consuming? And then that feeds back, right, into the kind of decisions that these brands make. And then even beyond that level of, you know, the representation, the image, the message, is the idea of who gets to have a seat at the table, right, within these companies, within these organizations, to make decisions about how we represent identity, about, you know, how we talk about things like social justice. So all of that is a piece of this puzzle.
We are talking about gender and food and marketing with our guest, Emily Cantois. Her new book is called Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. What questions do you have about this? Do you agree with her? Do you disagree with her? Do you find yourself buying things that are branded to men? We'd like to hear from you. So give us a call. Our lines are open, 800-642-1234. Or you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So Emily, do you think that the food industry is starting to change?
With regard to gender, I think we're seeing some change. And so what I do in the conclusion of my book is I go back to, you know, every product, every brand that I've studied and look at, like, what happened, right? Sort of from that 2016 moment on, which was a year of big reckoning in the United States as we think about multiple colliding issues when we think about society, culture, politics, and economics. And so some brands, right, stayed just as feminine or just as masculine, right? Some of them even doubled down. So for example, right, Powerful Yogurt, right, was this, you know, yogurt for men that, you know, not only came in this gigantic 8-ounce container that had six-pack abs chiseled into the plastic side. They, you know, not only, you know, very quickly stopped saying this is for men because it was good-tasting, high-protein yogurt. Women ate it as well. So they rebrand very quickly, right, that we're just for athletic people. But then Oikos Triple Zero from Danone took a similar kind of approach, but much more toned down. Their ads weren't nearly as misogynistic. But we do have black packaging and these ties with the NFL, with professional sports, which are still sort of held up as these masculine symbols, even as more and more women not only play sports or, you know, incredible sports stars, but also, like, the viewership for the NFL is also really close to gender equitable at this point. But the difference there is that Oikos actually slides back. They have an ad that comes out in 2020, like so recent, where they're using footage from the NFL draft, right? This day, you know, when men, you know, they've worked for it their whole lives. It's often a day we see men cry, right? Overcome with emotion of this amazing day. But this ad had the tagline, "Flex your triceps." Right, that we have to muscularize and masculinize this emotion of being drafted, and having that tied in, right, with this idea of yogurt being tied to protein and to athleticism. Mm-hmm. So that's a very recent, right, example that's sort of crawling backwards instead of forwards. But we have seen other shifts, right, and how we think about who's represented as cooking in ads, right, seeing more dads cooking, more dads being a part of sort of family food work. And then I also write in the conclusion about hard seltzers. And so I was kind of fascinated by White Claw, which at that point, you know, had made a big deal about saying we are purposefully taking a post-gender approach, right? We're not going to market this beverage as masculine or feminine or for women or for men. It's just for everybody, right? This dude-ish casual hang that everyone is invited to. And so it was interesting in how they took that approach to gender. And so it wasn't overtly feminized like some other hard seltzers were. And so it managed to sort of ungender the whole hard seltzer category. that it's perceived compared to things, you know, like Zima or, you know, hard lemonade, right, which continue to kind of be understood as these like feminized beverages that limited their sales success, that they wanted to tell this gender neutral story about hard seltzers, which industry experts point to now as sort of the biggest change in the alcohol industry since light beer, that it's this really interesting shift. And so I don't think it's actually gender neutral, but I think it's a very interesting moment to show that that like gender stereotypical target marketing really needs to be on the way out. And that when that's the position that brands adopt, it opens up big opportunity for sales, but also in thinking about what are you contributing to culture? How are you a part of this social moment and how we think of ourselves as consumers, but also as people?
Because really, if you think about that, you're opening up your market to, I mean, there's what? It's pretty much 50-50 in the world, right? Why are you confining your product to one part of it? That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
Exactly. So the people have said, why would you want to alienate half of your audience?
Exactly.
So that's what, you know, that's what Dr. Pepper 10 did, right? They straight up said, this is not for women.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't smart, right, from a sales perspective.
No, not at all.
But in thinking about, you know, how that campaign constructed a particular idea about masculinity, that still mattered, right? Even if it wasn't as successful in the marketplace.
Right, right. Our producer Natalie wants to know about Guy Fieri. Is that how he pronounces it? As a sort of the face of dude food, and how would you talk about that?
Yes. So Guy Fieri is chapter two, and it was one of my favorites to write. I always joke I could have written an entire book about the Guy Fieri empire and sort of the media persona, right, that he crafted for himself. And so he's referred to from quite early on, right, as the dude chef.
That
he resists, right, some of these demands of manhood, right, of how he wears, you know, shorts to work, and, you know, he's always enthusiastic, you know, yelling around at top volume with all of this enthusiasm. And so he really stretched the boundaries of, you know, a media figure of, you know, what a professional chef was supposed to look and act like, or a celebrity TV chef. That he really, you know, pushes the envelope with that mold that has a lot to do with these norms of masculinity and how we think about professional chefs. And then when it comes to dude food, you know, oftentimes that's what he was cooking on his very first show, which he wins after he's a contestant on, you know, Food Network, you know, the next Food Network star, that he's one of few folks to come out of that reality competition and, you know, actually make a really big successful career out of it. So from how he presents himself to the food that he cooks or the food that he eats, you know, particularly on Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives, which has had dozens and dozens and dozens of seasons, that he's really carried a flag, if you will, for dude food, and across, you know, sort of different, you know, ethnic and immigrant food markers, right? Sort of bringing this, you know, excessive, joyful, playful sort of perspective to food.
So is he kind of the gateway drug for men to get into cooking shows and not just the grill? Did he play that part?
That was part of the effort for Food Network, that they were trying to get more men to come to that primetime audience. And so Guy Fieri helped them do that. He was able to really pick up where Emeril Lagasse, you know, ends, right? Like, he definitely brought more men in as well and was also referred to as the dude chef. So I think there's a really nice lineage there as we think about how masculinity is represented on Food Network. And so definitely, I think not just with gender, I think gender is really important with him, but also this idea of class and access and populism, that Guy Fieri is viewed by many of his fans as being sort of anti-elitist, right? He's not looking down on you or trying to change your tastes. I think Julia Moskin, writing for the New York Times, you know, she went to one of Fieri's, you know, rock and roll cooking tours that he would do in stadiums in those earlier years. You know, and talking to people who were there, and I love one of the quotes of, you know, he's talking exactly to you, and he's not talking down to you, right? He's right there with you, loving the food that you love, which is a different message that they were perceiving from Food Network and from the food media establishment. For example, you know, he talks openly to people who, you know, don't like sushi, right? Who still think raw fish is a little bit taboo or weird and they don't want to eat it. You know, he's going to make barbecue chicken, you know, sushi, right? He meets you exactly where you are. He's very different, you know, from Alice Waters or, you know, another celebrity chef, you know, like, you know, Jamie Oliver, trying to elevate or change your view of nutrition or how you eat. Guy Fieri has this populist appeal where he really meets people where they are, makes them feel heard and seen. And so he has a really interesting, dedicated fandom that way. And I guess the last thing of why I found him so fascinating was how he was so polarizing. Folks either really loved him or they really hated him. And a lot of people have changed their minds about the hate, right? Everyone sort of come around to be a fan eventually. I've been so fascinated in the last couple of years, right? The idea, you see articles, you know, with headlines like Guy Fieri is, you know, the hero we need, and he's a genius, and that he's, you know, risen as this, you know, icon of sort of charitable work, right? Advocating. And so I think he retains that sort of apoliticalness of the dude as a character, right? That it's sort of at arm's length compared to someone like Jose Andres, right? Who's actually, right, going to lobby Congress, right, for legislation, for support. But Guy Fieri is going to interact in a different way, right? He isn't going to actually be a part of the political process. But nevertheless, right, has gained such public support in how we think of him as this good dude who's a part of food media.
Sure. We did get an email from Eve in Madison, and she asks, how does the LGBTQIA community factor into this gendering, you know, targeting of food and drink?
Yeah, I love this question, Eve, because I wrote this conclusion, you know, about White Claw and these claims of gender neutrality in a post-gender world, and got really interested in that, in thinking about, right, where are, you know, non-binary genders represented? How do we think about transgender individuals and how they're represented in food media and marketing? And then interestingly, you know, part of the dude of not only, right, sort of pushing or sort of protecting these boundaries of masculinity and femininity, but that's also about sexuality, right? Of sort of maintaining the powerful position of heterosexuality, of heteronormativity. And so thinking about how this is a figure, again, right, sort of maintained existing privileges. Because as we think about our food culture, it has been, right, incredible gay chefs and food writers who've really moved American food forward. I'm thinking about John Bertzall's incredible work on, you know, James Beard and Craig Claiborne, you know, incredible writers, cooks, cookbook authors, media figures, as they really put forth these ideas about good taste. And so that question of sort of sexuality and engaging with food is definitely an interesting one as I look at these norms that are so strictly heteronormative and are really quite anxious about maintaining these supposed boundaries, right, when we think about sexuality and gender. So I think that's a really good question and one that I definitely thought about a lot.
For sure. So do you think that the dude is on his way out at this point?
I do, and I think he deserves to be on the way out. I think, you know, White Claw is an example, right? Of that
right.
Sort of dude-ish, casual hang being extended to everyone.
Yes.
And I saw other brands try to do that. Diet Coke actually rebrands in 2018 with a campaign that's also, right, of, you know, do whatever you want, right? That it's trying to sort of extend that, you know, dude-ish privilege, you know, to just be and do and slack to everybody. So you definitely see, you know, women, you know, sort of comedians and celebrities being the voice of that campaign as well. So we've seen that kind of dudishness sort of remain, but be spread out and made somewhat more inclusive. But as we think about this whole question of gender stereotypes and types being used in advertising. Advertising is tricky. You know, I do this with my students, right? If you have 30 seconds or 15 seconds or 6 seconds, it's difficult to get a message across, let alone a nuanced one. So I have, empathy for how difficult the work of advertising and marketing is when it comes to something like that. But also to go back to that, you know, point about power of how advertising, media, marketing get to shape and reflect who we are, that they really need to step up to the occasion. And so the dude, deserves to be a passing fad that way.
And I'm sure he will be eventually. Do you think that there's like less resistance to gender bending food products now?
Oh, it sort of goes both ways. That the evidence that we have, right, is that younger people are definitely thinking about gender differently. Even, for me, teaching in Oklahoma, my students come mostly from this region. They have very different ideas, right, about the gender binary, about what gender means, about how we should move through the world, how we should act, what clothes we should wear, what pronouns we use, those sorts of things. So I think among younger folks, there is this more notable shift in being quite comfortable, right, with all sorts of gender bending. But there's still definitely this sort of pushback. I was just chatting with a guy who, regularly writes features for Men's Health. And he talks about, the pushback that he definitely gets from some readers when he's trying to show an example of masculinity that's more soft or more flexible, or what we might think of, right, as a little bit more feminine. That there's still definitely, trollish, unkind sort of comments or, pushback in that sort of way. So I don't think we're there yet, but I think there's definitely change underfoot. And I think the more flexibility and inclusiveness that we have, that's just better for everyone. I often, say that patriarchy, in the way it structures power, it hurts all of us, right? It definitely oppresses women more, but it also constrains the way that men can be men, be themselves, move through the world. So in thinking about those changes, they'll be great for all of us.
Very well said. And again, the book is Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. And the author we've been talking to, Emily Cantois. Emily, thank you so much for being with us and bringing this information, for something for us to actually notice, right?
I hope so. I hope we all go out into the grocery store, into restaurants, into your own kitchens, and think about food and gender a little bit differently. So I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. Again, the book is Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. Now, stay with us on the Ideas Network, because we're going to be back in just a few minutes to talk about the history of home economics. And a lot of what we just discussed with Emily, it pertains to what we're going to talk about with our next guest. So we'll see you in just a bit.